everyone. This is the podcast for the Orfila Center's Structural Violence, Police and Prison Abolition and Decoloniality Research Cluster. In this series, we feature the compelling works of different scholars and activists whose research touches upon violence, marginalization, and carcerality. Today, we're going to be talking with Alexandra Noy, who was very generous to give us some of her time. Alexandra Noy is a native of St. Petersburg, Russia, and is currently a fourth-year PhD student in the history department of the University of California, Santa Barbara. She studies modern Russian and Chinese history in a comparative perspective. She received a doctorate degree in modern Chinese literature from St. Petersburg State University in 2017. Having been raised in a metropolitan city, she enjoys art museums and theaters, and now in Santa Barbara, she's learning to appreciate the fun of hiking, surfing, and visiting national parks. Thank you so much, Alexandra, for speaking with us today. To begin with, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and about your research interests and trajectory? Why are you interested in studying authoritarianism and imprisonment?
Hi, Gihad, and hi, everyone. Thank you, Gihad, for inviting me. And so it's a pleasure to be part of this project. I'm interested in comparative practices of punishment and re-education in the 20th century Soviet Union and China, as well as in transitional justice. So specifically, I study the history of forced labor camps in those countries, the Soviet Gulag. And I'm also interested in what happened to survivors of camps after they were released and they were ready to re-enter society. And interestingly, the reforms of penal system in both of these countries happened along other reforms, for instance, judicial reforms in Soviet Union and China. And within those reforms, the prison systems had been significantly improved and the harshest elements of those systems were removed. And that took place in the 1950s in the Soviet Union after Joseph Stalin died, and in the 1970s in China after Mao Zedong's death. But interestingly, survivors in both countries returned to the same political regimes that had persecuted, imprisoned, and tortured them. And now the same regime started the processes of release and sometimes rehabilitation. So for me, transitional justice in authoritarian societies is a very interesting phenomenon study.
Thank you so much. I think that sounds very interesting. And we know that you're from St. Petersburg and that you studied comparative totalitarianism in St. Petersburg State University, comparing between China and Russia. So can you tell us a little bit about your scholarly background and how it led to your research interests now and how your scholarship has been changing and growing?
Thank you. So I did my bachelor's and master's degrees in China Studies in St. Petersburg State University, Department of Asian and African Studies. And I also did internships for 2 years in China. Then I completed a PhD program at my alma mater. And this PhD program in Russia, as everywhere in Europe, took 3 years to complete. It is called Candidate of Sciences degree. So I wrote a thesis on modern Chinese literature, and more specifically on the history of the communist fiction in Mao's China, so from 1949 to 1999. And as you can imagine, literature in a state where ideology is so important is very much affected by the political situation. And as I worked on my dissertation, I was really struck by the histories of Chinese writers who had been persecuted for their ideas, their writings and actions, and that they also had to fit their literature work into the communist or Maoist ideology. So many of them were imprisoned. They were sent to labor camps or to remote village farms to work. And I was really struck by the similarities between these stories and the stories of Soviet political prisoners during Stalinism. And obviously the stories about this infamous Gulag has always been part of my upbringing in Russia. So these two stories got connected, you know, in my mind as I work on the dissertation. And as to my family, so to my knowledge, no one in my family has been persecuted or worked for the Gulag system. But of course, I was raised with the knowledge of writings of, for instance, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, Varlam Shalamov, and other victims of the Gulag. So, and this is how I got interested in this history.
That's very interesting. And I think this idea of literature being a reflection of the times is also really important. So moving forward, why did you decide to tackle these subjects from history? And has your research given you perspectives into our contemporary political moments? Because we were just talking about how literature reflects the historical moment. So how has it been, first of all, moving to the study of history, and then second of all, learning about this history in our contemporary moment?
Yeah, thank you. So as I entered the PhD program at UCSB, I decided to become a historian. I thought, well, history is even more important than literature. And so I really wanted to study the Soviet and Chinese prison systems in comparative perspective, and also as a part of global systems of incarceration and persecution. And with the such violations of human rights in history of a particular state or regime, it is always closely tied to that, to the question of memory. Because when you have, as I mentioned, transitional justice, you have this legal aspects of it, like restitution, exoneration, compensation, you have punishment of the perpetrators, and these are all very important aspects. But how the memory of past injustices is kept in the community of the victims and in the society at large is also crucial for the processes of collective healing, of working through the historical traumas. So as time passes, it's important that we keep remembering the victims, that we know the names of the perpetrators, that we know the geography of crimes. So what happened and where, what places, towns, buildings, so this material history of crimes, for instance, the ruins and remnants of the prison camps. So all this work of transitional justice and remembrance has a direct connection to the present day. For example, in Russia, since the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, the traumas of the Gulag have not been worked through properly, because there has been a lot of resistance from the Russian state, from the authorities, to acknowledge the injustices of the Soviet period. And in fact, there have not been any serious structural reforms to change the prison institutions, the police, the punitive practices. And in the past decades, as the authoritarianism became stronger in Russia, these worst abuses of justice came back. So now we have political persecution, we have unlawful imprisonment, we have corrupt court system, we have terrible conditions in prison, and etc. And even in terms of geography of punishment, though the Gulag as an institution no longer exists in a legal sense, Russia still has prisons and penal colonies in the same remote regions where Gulag camps had been located. And though there is no forced labor, the inhumanity within the prison walls persists. So I definitely see this connections between the past, the memory, and the present day situation.
Yeah, that's very powerful, and it's really important to remember. And I think it's a very powerful thing that you really center memory in your research, and that you really think about how the Gulag still haunts our contemporary moment and there are still remnants. So I wanted to ask you a little bit more about the details of your research. Can you share with us any interesting stories or findings or any part of your research pertaining to imprisonment and the Gulag in the Soviet Union that has really shaped how you think, or that really changed your outlook on something when you came across it, or anything you find interesting for us to know?
Thank you for this question. I have a great story to tell. I made a historical discovery. So historians already know a lot about political prisoners in the Gulag, because there are sources, right? We have their memoirs, we have oral interviews with them. So this part of the story of the Gulag survivors is visible to a certain degree. But Gulag was a system that incarcerated different individuals, not only people persecuted for their beliefs or so-called political prisoners. But in fact, the majority of imprisoned population in the Gulag were common criminals, as we used to call them. So those were the people incarcerated for economic crimes, for example, or for robbery or for murder. And all these different categories of people shared the same space of the camp. They shared somewhat similar experience of forced labor and humiliation. And sometimes they, the common criminals are mentioned in the memoirs of political prisoners, but largely their stories still remain unknown, because they hardly left any traces. They hardly left any written recollections or any interviews. And again, it's partly because the experience was not seen as something unique or interesting to us to be asked about. Because after all, they committed their crimes and they served their sentences in prison. And I'm putting aside the question of fairness of their judgment, because we know that Soviet criminal law was very problematic. The discovery is that I found the traces of some of these former prisoners in the memoirs of scientists. So in the 1950s, there had been a lot of scientific expeditions in the Soviet Union in such fields as forestry science and geology. And the scientists wrote a lot about seasonal workers in their memoirs, in their essays. And they wrote that many of those workers had been previously imprisoned in the Gulag. So in these expeditions, we have scientists and former prisoners working together. They were, you know, working, surviving in the environment of Siberian taiga forests, which were very inhospitable. They shared meals together, so they had this shared experience together. And after memoirs, I looked at the documents of actual expeditions. And it's interesting that the identities of those workers as former prisoners are not there. They're not mentioned. But there is a lot in those documents about their skills and knowledge that those seasonal workers had. And it was their knowledge and their skills were really important for the success of the expeditions, for the production of scientific knowledge based on the research in the expeditions. And in fact, a lot of the skills and knowledge of the workers came from the experience of forced labor in the Gulag. For instance, they used to work in forest industry within the camps, and they had to endure very harsh working and living conditions. And they actually became very valued workers within those expeditions. So this part of the Gulag or post-Gulag story is not very well known, and hardly anyone has ever written about those workers, their Gulag identity. So I'm trying to restore this visibility. And this is important because it shows this nexus between incarceration and science. And we know that Gulag camps, a lot of them were scientific enterprises. So there were actually incarcerated scientists who worked inside the camps in special scientific laboratories, and they worked on different applied projects. And there's even this concept of carceral science, the science that capitalized on the Gulag. But what I'm trying to show in my work is that this carceral science was not confined to this institutionalized Gulag spaces, because the labor of former prisoners who became seasonal workers shows that the Soviet science continued to use the Gulag resources and legacies in its favor even after Joseph Stalin's death and after the Gulag had been dismantled as an institution.
I did not know about this. It's so interesting to hear about this, and it's so interesting to think about this idea of like a nexus between science and carcerality, and to think about knowledge production and its connections to authoritarianism and carcerality. So you've looked at the themes of authoritarianism and violence in a global perspective by studying it in both Russia and China. And I'm wondering how living in the United States as a graduate student may have added layers to your outlook on these themes, and how you think about global policing, carcerality, imprisonment, and the connections globally.
Yeah, living in the United States for the past 4 years and studying at UCSB definitely have a huge impact on me as a scholar. I've learned so much about the U.S. reentry programs, like halfway houses and other opportunities that are offered former prisoners, although they're not enough. And I think like the question of dignity of prisoners is very important. I joined some events at the UCSB Multicultural Center. For those events, the former prisoners were invited and they talked about their experience in the prison, but then the opportunities for them. I also was a part of a prison correspondence course. This is a restorative justice program run by UCSB Interdisciplinary Humanities Center. A really exciting program. It's offered for incarcerated individuals in California. So the program hires PhD students that correspond with those prisoners, and they correspond through literature. We write letters to them, and they analyze some literature text and write the responses. So the idea of this program is to help the prisoners build their portfolio. So once they are released and when they try to find a job, they have certain skills. At least they have critical thinking skills, which are very important. And for those individuals who are actually sentenced for life, it helps them not to feel alone in prison. It helps them know that there's somebody outside of prison who's talking to them through those texts. And this is definitely helping them restore their dignity. So what I center in my work has a connection to that, because I'm interested in what happened to people within prison walls of camp barbed wire and what happened after. We tend to think that release is a happy end, but in fact, the challenges for formerly incarcerated individuals continue. They certainly keep that social stigma. There's a huge rate of recidivism, for example, in my Gulag stories. So I definitely see these connections between U.S. carcerality and Soviet or Russian carcerality. And it's interesting to think about how during the Cold War era, there used to be this radical division between Western liberal democracy model and socialist model, whether it's Soviet or Chinese model. There used to be this understanding of the huge rupture between these. But the recent scholarly work has underscored the connections between the two models. It underscores how two different models of governance actually produce similar results in many ways. For example, we have a destruction of the natural environment due to exploitation and overproduction in both of the systems. And one of the scholars that had a huge impact on me in this, and one of the scholars who actually started this conversation, bridging together two different models of government, is Kate Brown. She has this great article from 2007. It's called Out of Solitary Confinement, The History of the Gulag, in which she talks both about the Gulag and about U.S. carceral system. And she sees a lot of connections between them. So in both countries, you had the prison industrial complex, you had abuses within prison system, tortures. She talks about two spatial regimes in both models, and she sees the Gulag as located along this continuum of incarcerated space, because beyond the Gulag, you also had a lot of restrictions on people's mobility. In the Soviet Union, you had this very complicated passport system. In the U.S., you had the racial discrimination, segregation, redlining, a lot of similar phenomenon. And another work actually in which she again tries to, it's a kind of a tandem history between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. It's the book is called Plutopia, and she talks about two nuclear plants in the U.S. and in the Soviet Union, which again produced very similar results. I mean, for a lot of nuclear accidents, contamination, inequality in both of these places. So overall, it's interesting to study how structural violence, injustice and mass incarceration and inequality keep being reproduced, no matter what economic or political system we are looking at.
I agree completely. And I would say even like from a Middle East studies perspective, that you can definitely see connections with the Soviet carceral system. And, you know, of course, a lot of connections between like U.S. carcerality and the Middle East. So I'm glad that you mentioned Kate Brown and her scholarship, because my next question was going to be about the most kind of inspiring scholarship or books that you've come across that have guided your work, or if you feel like there are, you know, certain must-read works for people that are thinking about the Gulag. Do you have any recommendations?
Yeah, sure. There are lots of great work specifically centering the Gulag and violence in the Soviet Union. But I would love to talk about another book which has a very broad argument, and I'm trying to apply this argument to my work. This is a book by a Russian historian and cultural historian, Alexander Etkin. It's a book from 2011 called Internal Colonization, Russia's Imperial Experience. So in this book, Etkin locates cultural distances and hierarchies that define colonialism in the Russian Empire. And he sees this colonialism as internal. So it's directed towards Russian peasants, Russian religious sects, and he sees this internal colonialism in the dramatic clash between the Russian intelligentsia, which is educated elites, and the ordinary people. He shows how the Russian state and its elites orientalized the rest of the population because they viewed them as different, as other, as in need of civilization. And he argues that this colonial view was applied to both non-Russian and Russian subjects of the empire. But it's also interesting to think about how his approach is close to understanding of internal colonialism in theories of decolonization and the studies of indigeneity. For example, in decolonial framework, we have this racialized treatment of American indigenous peoples, Black and Latino communities, other marginalized populations. So all this treatment of these marginalized populations is seen as both external and internal colonialism, and I'm really interested in in making those connections across different fields. And as an application to my work, actually other scholars have already started applying this framework to the study of the Gulag. They have argued that the construction of labor camps in the remote regions of the Soviet Union, really in the hinterland, then the mobilization of free workers from densely populated areas to perform wage labor in this new unpopulated territories. So they see these processes as internal colonization.
In the next question, I wanted to ask you about your outlook on the intersections between scholarship and activism. So do you see the two as linked? And what political work do you think studying the Gulag, authoritarianism, and imprisonment historically can do? And I think your earlier responses about memory could also come into this equation.
Yes, thanks for this question. I think about this a lot. I definitely think that studying history and doing being an activist, these two processes are very much linked. I see myself as a historian and as an activist at the same time. So it's basically two in one. Because I think that studying the past is important, but then we should see the implications of this past for the present day. It's obvious that sources of many contemporary problems are located in the past and in the past historical traumas that have not been addressed properly. For example, in Russian case, Russia is still seen as a colony by its elites. We see natural resources in Russia as being used and exported outside and oligarchs making money on that. We see the corruption. It's all the same mentality of Russian territories being a colony. Well, we see Russian colonialism and imperialism and war with Ukraine, unfortunately. And memory questions have a direct link to this ideas and to my work. For example, one of the major organizations in Russia that worked for decades with these questions of past injustices, it is called Memorial. This is how it's pronounced, the Memorial Historical Society. It has a lot of branches in different Russian cities and towns. And for decades, this organization has done a lot of work keeping the memory of the Soviet era political repressions. But this organization has always seen the historical continuity between Soviet era repressions and Russian contemporary persecution of political activists, and saw the connection between Soviet era abuses and human rights abuses in the present day Russia. For instance, Russia has a Federal Security Service, which is a successor of KGB. KGB is a successor of 1930s secret police and KVD. So it's basically the same institution. And if we want to build new Russia, this institution has to be abolished completely. Another thing in Russia is this conversation about labor within Russian prisons. For example, in the past years, Russia has experienced the lack of workforce, because a lot of migrants from Central Asia that used to work in Russian industries. They left during the COVID-19 pandemic. And as economic crisis intensifies in Russia, it's just less reasonable for them to come back to Russia to work. And so there's this new idea promoted by the prison authorities. This new idea is to use prisoners to work. And they're talking about voluntary and paid labor. They're not talking about forced labor. Mm-hmm. But we wonder who is going to keep that promise. You know, what are those independent organizations in Russia that they're going to make sure that the prisoners' rights as workers are being upheld? And well, overall, I think we scholars write books and articles. We publish. We speak at conferences, which is very important. But as we see, the mistakes are still being made, and which means that people don't learn from history. They don't learn from our writings and historians. Maybe our books are too long to read. So I think we as historians definitely need to reach out to wider audiences more. We need to find ways to convey the history. We need to explain why and how we need to learn from the history. And my belief is that we cannot change the past, but we can start in the present to change the future.
You know, you shared with us so much knowledge today. Thank you so much. I personally learned a lot from just listening to you. So is there anything else that you would like to add? Or is there anything that I haven't asked you about that you think is important to share with us for thinking about carcerality and imprisonment? And are there any side projects that you're currently working on that you'd like to share with us?
Yeah, sure. There's a project that I'm really excited about. It's a digital project that I'm currently working on. And this digital project is about mapping the Gulag camps and the scientific expeditions that took place near the camps. So both during Stalinism and then later in the 1950s. And again, this project is going to show, I hope, this entanglement of incarceration and science. And I hope that when people look at this project, they will see just the sheer scale of it. When I put everything on the map and I use visual means to show that to the audience. And in general, as I mentioned before, I think it's important to reach out to different people and to use different means, not only writing books, but also use some new tools to produce historical work.
Thank you so much, Alexandra. This was so interesting, and I'm really excited to see where your research is going and to learn more from you.
Thank you so much, Gihad, and I'm really grateful for the Orfolia Center to have this opportunity to participate and to share my work.
Thank you so much.